London Calling.
London calling to the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing. Except for the rain and the crunch of things. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is going in. Engines stop running, but I have no fear. Cause London is drowning. I live by the river to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go in alone. London calling to the zombies of death. Quit holding out and draw another breath.
While North Americans suck contentedly at the gas pumps, there's been a lot of climate action in Europe. To find out about this summer's climate camps and the run-up to December's Copenhagen Climate Conference, we are joined by Phil England, host of the 300-350 show on Resonance FM in London. Welcome, Phil.
Hi there. Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
Oh, it's so good to speak to you. I first want to ask you, can you tell us what a climate camp is?
Okay, I think it's, there's four main elements to it. One is education, one is movement building, one is sustainable living, and what's the fourth element? Direct action against the root causes of climate change. I mean, basically, this has been happening for about 4 years now in the UK, where people pitch up with their tents and camp out generally near the site of a large coal-fired power station or a planned site of an airport expansion, and get together and live sustainably for about a week. So basically they set up quite an incredible infrastructure of compost toilets, renewable energy systems, and kind of vegan cooking, which they kind of put together very quickly over a couple of days. So there's a complete infrastructure for low-impact living. And then there's an amazing workshop program. This year's Climate Camp in London, there was about 8 different workshops going on at the same time and about 4 workshop slots during a day. And this was happening over the course of about 5 days. So it was probably a couple of hundred workshops. Quite an amazing feat to realize all this, really. And on top of that, training in direct action, because basically the idea is that action on climate change really isn't matching up to the scale that the science is telling us, the kind of level of urgency that we need and rapidity of government action. It's just not happening. So this is a kind of just a kick up the butt, really, for the politicians, but also trying to figure out how to live sustainably and work together to actually bring some of these changes about directly ourselves as well.
And people can find out what they can do legally, what their rights are, and you end up with some crazy actions. I read that somebody glued themselves to the floor, for example, that kind of thing. Anyway, I wanted to mention that the folks at Climate Camp set up their own radio station, calling it Dissident Island Radio. You can Google for that or find it on radioforall.net. Now, Phil, one story from those hours of useful on-site programs really hit me. The UK's only factory producing big wind turbines has been shut down and the rotor blades shipped offshore. So, I mean, you've got the British government, like everybody else, blabbering about green jobs. What happened there?
Yeah, this was an amazing contradiction that came to light on the kind of front pages. Shortly after the UK had done some more of its grandstanding about its low carbon transition strategy, its national plan. Yeah, one of the biggest, well, the biggest wind turbine factory said it was going to shift its operations to Texas, I think, or certainly somewhere in the United States where there was a lot more demand. Basically, what's holding up a lot of wind developments in the UK is planning applications, the planning system. A lot of people object to having wind power developments in their kind of neighbourhood. So it's the local planning system which is kind of clogged up currently with a lot of objections.
Yes, you can have a filling station, and we can all gasp in the poisoned air, but heaven forbid we should have a wind tower slowly rotating along the hill. Well, I'm also wondering, you know, many of us here in North America look to Britain and Europe as more progressive on climate, and yet I'm reading that the UK government sometimes uses anti-terrorism methods against these camps and forced One Green Festival into bankruptcy this summer. Is that why the location of the camps aren't announced ahead of time?
Yeah, absolutely. The feeling is that these camps just wouldn't happen if the location was revealed before time. So that's the one area of openness that is kind of restricted between when there's kind of the talks between the police and the activists take place before the camp. That's the one thing that isn't given away. But the funny thing about this year's camp was that after so much public criticism and various inquiries that happened into recent policing of events, the policing was pretty much non-existent, which was remarkable because it just turned the camps into a place from being quite stressful to being much more like a kind of holiday atmosphere. And it proved on the one hand that these camps are very able to police themselves, in a sense. They have very good policies and processes for sorting out any disagreements that might arise, and the site has now been returned to a much better state than any festival would have. A lot of waste. This site is now completely returned to its original state, essentially.
So a bunch of humans can get together without leaving trash all over the place. You know, I try and stay in touch with activism here, but I didn't know there were climate camps organized in the United States and Canada. I didn't read anything about them in the newspaper. Funny that. But can you tell us what you've heard about other climate camps around the world?
Yeah, I think there's around 15 now across the globe this summer. And in fact, some of them are kind of later in the year, in the kind of lead up to the Copenhagen talks, the United Nations climate talks at the end of the year. There's three in Australia, one in New Zealand. There's a whole bunch across Europe. There was four in the UK and Ireland. And yeah, I think they're even, I won't say even, because I think last year there were some climate convergences, I think they're called, in the US. I think there was three last year, and I think there's at least two this year. One in Pittsburgh and one in Richmond, California. Coming up later in September, so I think if you Google climate convergence, they'll come up. Yeah, I think you alerted me to the direct action training that's happening across Canada that Greenpeace is starting to organise, particularly to raise the issue of tar sands.
Yes, if you go to greenpeace.ca, you can get the details on that. Well, I would like to move on to the international negotiations for a new climate treaty to be held in December in Copenhagen. And, you know, I know some of my listeners are starting to yawn, and myself, I'd sort of despaired about these. But I think that was a mistake. I've just heard a speech from Bill McKibben, who started up that website, 350.org. And listening to Bill, I realized we can't give up. This may be our best chance, maybe our only chance, to steer away from this climate precipice. So can you tell us, why should the average listener care about what's happening in Copenhagen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important opportunity. I mean, it's a long way from happening. You know, what we need is a scientifically robust and fair deal. And because we've left it so late in the day, the level of action that is required now is very dramatic. We have a very small carbon budget really left to play with over the next few decades. So we need a very strong agreement. And yeah, I mean, if we all have a framework as countries throughout the world, if we're all working together towards the same aim, if we know that everyone's working to solve this problem out, and really that's the only way that it's, that we're going to make this thing happen and achieve some kind of degree of climate stability, then yeah, an international agreement is our kind of best shot, really. But there's a lot of obstacles, there's a lot of ground to cover, really, over the next few months. And really, the ball is in the rich world's court. That's North America, Europe, Australia, you know, Japan, really have to pull their fingers out and start taking this issue seriously, making big cuts, and also putting real finance on the table to both enable low-carbon development in poor countries, but also to recognize that we have a carbon debt, really. We've caused the vast bulk of the climate change that has happened and is going to happen over the next few decades is kind of built into the system. And, you know, the countries feel the worst impacts of that shouldn't be left to fend for themselves. We have a duty to kind of help them adapt to some of the impacts that are inevitable. So we need to put a lot of money on the table to make this deal fair and scientifically sound.
Is there an organization of developing states or NGOs about this, and what are they asking for?
Well, the biggest grouping historically has been the Climate Action Network. But I think a lot of people now feel that they kind of are probably too weak to support. Maybe they're changing, but historically they supported all the flexible mechanisms that made the Kyoto Protocol such a weak agreement. So people like Friends of the Earth International, which is about 70 national organizations right across the world and working in quite a democratic way, they've pulled out of the Climate Action Network and have joined a group called Climate Justice Now, which is a very big grouping of civil society organizations right across the globe, particularly from the poor majority world. And they're kind of challenging, really, the Climate Action Network to go for something much more radical. So they're putting justice at the heart of what they're asking for. And that's that movement is taking off in quite a big way.
Well, you know what's going to be said. Sure, we may have wrecked the world, but we're too broke to pay for it now. We just gave all our money to the bankers. So, you know, the public's not going to be in a mood, I would judge, to support paying for the pollution that we've caused. It's going to be a real tough problem to get by.
Yeah, I think national leaders need to start making the case to their populations. And there's a big call for heads of state to come along to the climate talks in December to make sure that, you know, significant action can take place, that it's not just down to environment ministers. Finance ministers should also be there. Heads of state should be there as well. But really, yeah, with the banking bailout, we showed what could be done, what kinds of levels of finance could be raised at short notice if it was felt there was an emergency. And of course, the climate emergency is so much bigger than the economic crash. Basically, if we don't have an environment, we can't have an economy. The economy is a subset of the environment and not the other way around. We all depend on the environment for our survival. So that's the one thing that it really is too big to fail.
Absolutely. I've got to agree with you. You know, aside from Bill McKibben, another inspiration for me lately to get involved with these negotiations rather than just bitching about them has been George Monbiot, the author and columnist in Britain's Guardian newspaper. His column for August 31st says we have to act quickly on greenhouse gases or it will simply be too late. The science is in, but I still hear politicians sort of like dinosaurs promising to start cutting emissions back maybe in 2025 or 2050 after you and I may well be dead. Well, are some of the real targets emerging in time before Copenhagen?
Well, yeah, there are country groups within the United Nations talks that are putting quite scientifically credible targets on the table. You have the Association of Small Island States, and you also have the least developed countries. These two country blocks between them comprise about well over 80 countries, and there's 192 countries sat around the table at the UN. So really, they are representing quite a body of people there, and they're suggesting, well, they've backed the 350 parts per million CO2 equivalent target that Bill McKibben is campaigning for, based on the James Hansen science, so that's all good, solid stuff. But they're also saying that global temperature increase should be limited to 1.5 degrees centigrade, which is a much more demanding and safer target than what the Obama-led Major Economists Forum recently agreed to, which was the 2 degrees C target, which is now 16 years old. Europe came up with that target 16 years ago based on what is now a very old science, and we understand now that serious impacts are going to take place at much lower temperature thresholds. So 1.5 degrees C is a much safer target to go for. So yeah, these are the countries that we have to listen to if we're going to get a kind of scientifically credible deal. And it's worth bearing in mind that the major economies forum that Obama convened and was grandstanding about, this 2 degrees C target, they only represent 39 countries. One other interesting thing that happened recently was that the European Environment Commissioner recognized that 2 degrees C was no longer safe. So it'll be interesting to see if there's any movement within Europe to acknowledge at a policy level that they can no longer stick to this outdated 2 degrees C target, and maybe we'll see a whole shift towards the 1.5 degrees C and 3 parts per million targets now.
Well, it's going to be tough, but it's got to be done. Now, here on the west coast of North America, basically we're dodging the fires and the smoke, and down in Australia they're having one of the hottest winters they've ever had. They're getting 35-degree, 38-degree C temperatures in the winter. And, you know, those are just parts of a broad current of things that are happening around the world. We're talking with Phil England. He hosts the 300-350 show in the UK, and note he renamed his climate radio program to that carbon target. I recommend listening to Phil's back shows found at climateradio.org, and you can get every new program by podcast. Is there anything you'd like to tell us as we wrap up, Phil?
Well, one other thing you should drop into your closing announcements is the web address for beyondtalk.net, which is, I think, an initiative of the Yes Men and Greenpeace, these kind of pranksters that expose corporate lies. They are encouraging people to sign up and commit themselves to direct action in the lead-up to Copenhagen, to right across the US essentially, but also I think across the globe, to really make the shift that we kind of need to see before Copenhagen. So,
and I'm sorry, I missed the name. It's Beyond what?
Beyondtalk.net.
Ah, beyondtalk.net. All right, we'll tune into that. And also remember, folks, climateradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Phil, and I hope we can have these conversations from time to time.
Okay, yeah, sure. That would be good.
All right, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.